Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We've all heard the dire warning. The global population is booming, 11.2 billion by the end of the century. So the planet will groan under the strain, and in the worst case, ecosystems could collapse, food and water shortages, mass migration. But our guests today say, hang on for just a minute, those UN population predictions could be all wrong. That, in fact, humanity is on the brink of a population decline, and not because of an apocalyptic global pandemic, but because of deep systemic changes in how we're living around the world. But before you celebrate, consider this too, that our guests say there's a whole new set of challenges that come along with slowing growth rates, and many nations may not be ready for them. So this hour on Point, diffusing the population bomb. And you can join us. Do you see evidence that human population growth rates may be slowing? Are we prepared for the consequences that could come with that? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today from Ottawa, Canada, is John Ibbotson. He's a longtime political journalist, columnist, and author, and now writer-at-large for The Globe and Mail, and one co-author of a new book we'll be talking about. John Ibbotson, welcome to you.
Hello.
And also with us today from Paris, France, is John's co-author, Daryl Bricker. He's CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs, a global market research and consulting firm. Daryl, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me on.
And John and Daryl are co-authors together of the new book, Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. All right. So John and Daryl, let me just start with a very basic question to you. And John, I'll turn to you first here. You know, as you know, I read that the UN predicts that global population in the year 2100 will be more than 11 billion people. Do you not agree with that number? And if so, how much do you think it's going to be?
No, we don't. The book basically channels a group of dissident demographers who claim that the UN number is based on some false assumptions, and that if you correct those false assumptions, you get very different numbers. Essentially, the planet's population peaks at around 9 billion somewhere in the middle of the century, and then it starts to go down. And it goes down sharply. We could be back to around 7 billion people by the end of the century. And if you say, well, fine, now let's check back in 30 years and find out who is right. The fact is that this is already being felt around the world. There are now about 24 countries that are losing population every single year. And some of the biggest countries in the world, such as China and Brazil, will soon join them. So it's something that's actually happening right here, right now.
Okay, so Daryl, tell us more then. Are we talking about basically slowing growth rates around the world?
What we're talking about here is mostly cultural change. So it's the context in which we make decisions about the types of families that we want to have. And just about everywhere in the world, it's universal. The decision that's being made by women in particular is that they want to have smaller families. And when they make that decision and we get on that pattern and that becomes more of the norm, that is the result. We have smaller families, which is not necessarily being factored in. It's actually not being factored in by the UN right now, which really has a very conservative model of how to look at population change, which is why not only us or John and I are challenging this perspective, but we're, as John said correctly, channeling a whole bunch of other demographers around the world who feel the same.
Okay, so let's touch down on some of the countries that you visited and write about in the book to get a better sense as to what we may see happening right now. So, John, tell us a little bit. I mean, one end of the extreme is Japan. What's its situation regarding its current population, its growth rate or not growth rate, and what impacts may that have?
Well, Japan is a great example. It lost about 450,000 people last year. that is a lot of people to lose, and it will continue year after year after year for a couple of reasons. One is Japan is aging. It has a very low fertility rate. You need 2.1 children per woman on average to sustain your population. Japan is close to one. It is almost a full baby below replacement rate. So you have an aging society, and you have a society in which every year there are fewer young people than there were the year before. Over time, this has an impact. There are fewer young people available, for example, to pay taxes, to sustain health care and pensions for older people. And there are fewer young people to drive the economy through consumption. Consumption is the biggest factor in the economic growth of any society. And if you have fewer people buying houses, buying cars, buying baby strollers every year than there were the year before, in the case of Japan, 450,000 of them, then that is going to have, over time, an impact on your economy. And if you might have noticed, Japan is sort of in the third decade now of stagnant or no economic growth.
But Daryl Bricker, I mean, the other thing that Japan doesn't do as much as, say, the United States, for example, is immigration, right? Because the overall birth rate in the U.S. is at a 30-year low, right? It's 1.7, 1.8 per women. But because of immigration, the population in the United States continues to grow.
It does. And the countries that have been able to figure out how to make immigration work for them are the ones that are resisting this trend most successfully. Japan is one of those countries in which it's very, very difficult to become a Japanese, somebody who's a naturalized Japanese citizen. So even if they have people move there, it tends to be more on a temporary basis. So the problem of dealing with the issue of declining population is you've got two solutions. One of them is you try to find a way to make more babies, because that's the way that that we have dealt with that issue in the past. But the other way is through immigration. And the countries that can be very clever about how they manage that process have the best chances as we go through this this century to hold on to population.
But John, let me turn back to you for a second before we leave talking about Japan. Because, you know, in the process of preparing for this conversation, our producers reached out to several other economists and demographers to sort of get a sense as to what they think about the thesis that you're putting forth here. And one of them, Steve Bannister, a professor of economics in Utah, said about Japan, you know, you mentioned the overall GDP of Japan sort of stagnating, but he said we ought to be focusing on per capita growth in Japan. And on that rate, he says that they're actually doing pretty well. He says their per capita GDP continues to seem unabated by population decrease. And in fact, it may be a model for how we want to see future economies work, that in the second half of this century, we'll just see older folks consuming more. So the overall economy in Japan isn't as bad off as the strict GDP number might let it seem.
And one of the things that we say in the book is that we don't want to get into economic modeling, you know, what it's going to look like two or three decades down the road. Sure. I mean, Japan also has the highest per capita debt of any developed nations. But it's not the point. We may well be able to manage economic changes. We will certainly enjoy great environmental benefits from having fewer people. There will be big geopolitical challenges ahead, as well as some countries decline in population, such as Japan. Japan's neighbor China, and others continue to sustain their populations. But what matters is we need to figure out, or at least get across the idea that the conventional wisdom, the conventional assumptions that the population of the world just goes up and up and up is wrong. It's going to level off and go down. That is a very big piece of information in and of itself before we start, you know, figuring out what the consequences are 20 or 30 years down the line.
Right. So, Daryl, let me turn back to you. I mean, just I'd love to sort of explore some of the other nations that, again, you visited and write about in the book. Let's move over to Europe, right? We could talk about any number of European nations right now. How about Italy? What are we seeing there?
Well, as we quote the one of the ministers in the government saying, we are a dying nation. And that's pretty much the trend across most of Europe today. I'm in Paris, France, and you know, this book has just come out, and visiting with my colleagues in my office, and it's very interesting. They say, you know, that's not what people know about what's going on in France, but the birth rate in France is below two. And they say, well, you know, now that I've looked at what you said, and I look at all my friends, and I look at my families, and I look at what's happening around me, I actually see this going on. And we're seeing this throughout Europe, where we have populations that are either declining or on the verge of declining. And one of the questions that they deal with as they are challenged by this is the question of immigration, which has become a big driver of some of the populist forces that you're seeing not just in France, but you're seeing in many other countries as well.
Exactly. Well, what about, I mean, obviously 40% of the world's population is in two nations, right? China and India. And as many people might know, China not that long ago ended its one-child policy and is actually trying to encourage Chinese women to have more babies. So that's in China. India, though, was long considered to have, you know, a higher population growth rate than China. Is India maintaining that trajectory?
Yeah, we have to confess here there's a big mistake in our book. In our book, we say that the fertility rate of India is coming down fast and that it's a 2.4, although there were some demographers in India who suspect that that 2.4 number is not right. It isn't right. The new data came out in November in The Lancet, a study from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. India's at 2.1. Since we wrote the book, the number has changed from 2.4 to 2.1. India is now at replacement rate, and that number will continue to go down. So if China is half a baby short and India is now at replacement rate, that accounts for about 40% of the world's population right there.
Hmm. Now, you know, I want to talk more about the underlying forces that you both identify as driving these changes in how we may view or might view population growth around the world here. We'll do that when we come back from a break. But Daryl, let me just ask you a quick question in the minute that we have left before the break. One thing which I think it tends to get a little confusing is when we talk about absolute numbers versus population growth rates. And a lot of demographers might look at your work and say, what we're also not talking about is this issue of population momentum, right? That we already have more than 7 billion people on the planet. A lot of them are young people who haven't yet had children. And so no matter what, even if growth rates slowed quite dramatically, we're still going to have a lot more people put on the planet regardless. So, I mean, do you address that in the book?
You don't directly address it, but the point on that is that, yes, there is some form of population momentum that exists that's undeniable. But the big mistake that people are making when they talk about it is they think that the population of the future is going to behave like the population of the past, and they don't. And that's the point of the book.
Well, Daryl Bricker and John Ibbotson, stand by. They're both co-authors of Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. And what do you think? What's your reaction to hearing John and Daryl say, we may not hit that 11 billion mark in terms of global human population by the end of the century, that in fact it may be much less than that, or perhaps even right where we are now at 7 billion. What's your question for John Ibbotson and Daryl Bricker? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with John Ibbotson and Daryl Bricker. They are co-authors of the new book, Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. And we have an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. And John Ibbotson and Daryl Bricker talk about how some demographers think that estimates of having an 11 billion global population of human beings on planet Earth by 2100 is wrong. That, in fact, humanity might be on the edge of a precipitous population decline. So, John and Daryl, I want to explore with you and hear more from you about what you see as the underlying reasons for why we might be on this, the edge of this population decline, that basically kind of falls into two categories. One is urbanization, and the other has to do with women and advancements for women in their lives. So let's start with urbanization. Tell me a little bit more. Why is the constant movement of people into cities one of the reasons for lowering birth rates?
Well, you're right. The planet, for the first time in human history, we became more urban than rural about a decade ago. And this process of urbanization is accelerating throughout the developing world. And a couple of interesting things happen when you move from the countryside into the city. The first thing that happens is a child stops being an asset, another pair of hands to work in the fields, and becomes a liability, just another mouth to feed. So there's this economic imperative to have fewer children once you leave the village and move into the city. And the second thing that happens is that women, as you mentioned, have access to education and information that they didn't have before. There's a school system available to them that might not have been available to them in the village. There's mass media available to them. Other women are available to them. They can talk to each other. And as women become better educated, and again, this is a universal around the world from Reykjavik to East Timor, as women become better educated and more empowered, they begin to make demands over the right to choose for themselves how many children that they want to have. And again, everywhere around the world, no matter what society you're in, once women have the ability to have some say over their own bodies and over how many children they choose to have, they choose to have fewer children than their mothers did.
Hmm. And so I mean, tell me more about the urbanization aspect of this here, because I think is there no counter evidence to population growth rates and urbanization? Because shouldn't we have seen this effect then earlier? Because we've been on the urbanization trend for quite some time.
No, actually we haven't.
Okay.
It's something that's really accelerated since the 1960s. So if you take a look at the world in 1960, about a third of us lived in urban areas. If you look at it today, it's about 55%. It's a massive, massive movement of people. So a great example of this is Brazil, where the birth rate has crashed from 6 in 1960 to 1.8 today, at the same time as their population is completely flipped. Back in 1960, 80% of the Brazilian population lived in rural areas and 20% lived in cities. It's completely reversed now. So there's a very high degree of correlation between that declining birth rate, as John was saying, and the fact that people are becoming urban. And urbanization is accelerating in the world.
Mm. I suppose quite some time in my life is starting in the 1960s. But so to get back to this issue of, I mean, I think it's long been understood that whenever women get greater access to education, to economic empowerment or economic freedom, that, as you said, the first thing they do is they say, I don't want to have so many children. But are we seeing this everywhere around the world when those advancements happen?
Again, yes, it's okay. Universal. And it's as you said, it's about the empowerment of women. It's about the economic factors of a child becoming an economic liability. A couple of other things are in play. There isn't a religion anywhere in the world that in its traditional form doesn't say that women should be subordinate to men, that they should stay at home, they should get married early, and they should have lots of babies and respect their husbands. Religion tends to be very powerful in rural societies. But as you move into an urban environment, the power of religion wanes. We're looking at the Philippines, for example, where, again, the fertility rate is crashing and where the Catholic Church is very alarmed that the attendance of Mass is down below 40% of the population. And there's something else as well. In rural environments, the clan is very powerful, your extended family, the aunties who are telling you that you should get married and settle down and have kids. Once you move into the city, the power of the clan declines. Then it's replaced by peers, by friends, by co-workers. When was the last time a co-worker told you that you should have a baby? So these are all things that, as you move from a rural environment into an urban environment, depress the likelihood that a woman is going to have more children.
Hmm. So let me just ask you this. In reading your book and preparing for this conversation and watching other interviews that you've done, I'm just wondering, even though it seems like perhaps this is a good thing, that if it's true that global population growth rates are slowing quite dramatically, I'm still not hearing you bring a sort of resoundingly optimistic tone, though. Here, there are new problems that are coming along with this. Is what you're saying, and that we're not prepared for them. So, what are some of those new problems?
Well, first thing is that the purpose of the book was not to necessarily solve all the problems, as John was saying, or even identify all the problems going forward. The purpose of the book was to say, look, you have – listen, world. You have this accepted knowledge, this received wisdom, what we call vertical knowledge, that everybody knows that the world's population is going to continue to expand, you know, ad infinitum, and you need to get ready for the population bomb. So the purpose of the book is to say to people, well, actually, that's wrong. We need to have another conversation. And the other conversation is that the population is going to peak and it's going to decline, which introduces a whole different series of problems other than what those other Cassandras are talking about that are going to confront the world. And we need to start with understanding the denominator in the equation, which is the size of the population. But I think we identify in the book, we say, look, you know, going to be great for the environment. We can go into the details of why that's the case, but probably going to be a really big challenge for the economy. And that's basically how it works out. So what we say is it's not a good thing, it's not a bad thing, but it's a big thing, and we need to understand it.
Yeah. Well, let's take a couple calls here if we can. Let's go to David, who's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. I think it's a great thing. For every environmental problem gets worse as population increases, and I can cite John Holdren for that. He was President Obama's science advisor, and he taught me about global warming in 1975. I was at a symposium on agriculture and global warming at the AAAS convention in 2011. The three researchers painted a potentially optimistic picture about feeding the world in 2050. At the Q&A, I asked them what global warming was going to do to their projections. It was as if a dark cloud suddenly descended on the researchers. The guy who was answering questions just shrugged his shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Global warming will reduce the number of people that Earth can support. A declining population may actually help humankind survive with a minimum of misery. It may stop the current Anthropocene extinction, and it gives me hope for the twins that are about to be born to my brother's daughter-in-law.
Yeah. Well, David, can I just jump in here for a second? I was wondering if you had a question for John and Daryl here, or is it just more a comment about the relationship between what global? Okay.
I just wanted to say that I'm sure humans are clever enough to figure out how to live well with a declining population.
Yeah.
They won't be able to live well if the population keeps exploding.
Right. Well, thank you so much for your call, David. Let's go to Nate, who's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. And I do appreciate your guests trying to clear up the numbers that people were getting wrong about what's going to happen. But I was also going to pour some cold water on what I think is rose-colored glasses and their vision, in that I am still very worried about environmental problems because I have never seen the number of people as the primary environmental problem, but rather the economy and how that economy pollutes and interacts with the environment. Just consider that if you chop the current world population down to a quarter of what it is, but have every single person living in an economy that pollutes per person as much as the U.S. economy does,
right,
the planet gets worried. It gets ruined. So I'm still concerned about global warming, and I think that how our economy interacts with that is really the key thing.
Well, Nate, thank you so much for your call, and very interesting point. Daryl and John, I was wondering if you wanted to respond to that, that in terms of, say, things like climate change, you heard Nate say it doesn't really matter how many people we have for as long as the manner in which we're pumping emissions into the atmosphere isn't changing. The economy is a problem, not the absolute number of people.
Yeah, and again, we don't want to get into the debate over economic consumption and growth and capitalism and the impact on the developing world of all of those things. We do, however, agree that in terms of global warming, it's great news if we top out at 9 billion and start to go down, both because the fewer people will produce fewer emissions, but also because you will have a conversion of marginal farmland. As people move into the cities, marginal farmland will go back to bush, something we've seen in the United States and Canada happening on a vast scale already. And as that happens, then the bush itself acts as a great carbon sink and it promotes biodiversity. So, yeah, there is nothing but good news on the side of population decline happening sooner rather than later in this century. Economic consequences, sure, but environmentally, all of the good.
Yeah, I think, I mean, our caller Nate might disagree with you because he was pointing, you know, that to per capita emission rates in developed countries are higher, obviously, than those with in developing nations with much larger populations. But let's get back to this question of what the population will be in 2100 or what the predictions are. So John and Daryl, just stand by for a moment because I want to bring into the conversation John Bongartz. He's joining us from Armonk, New York. He's a demographer and vice president and distinguished scholar at the Population Council, an international NGO that conducts research to address critical health and development issues around the world. He's actually one of the world's leading demographers. So John Bongartz, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So what do you make of what John Ibbotson and Daryl Bricker here are saying, that, you know, they talked to some demographers who believe this and traveled around the world? Are they right in saying that we're not going to hit that 11 billion mark in 2100?
Well, we cannot say for sure what will happen, but we can listen to the best experts on this topic. And those are the people at the United Nations Population Division. They have made projections for decades, and those projections have turned out to be quite accurate. They have teams of dozens of experts who consult with countries to get the numbers right. And their best guess is that it will be 11 billion. And I would say the large majority of the demographic community around the world accepts these results. Now, that is not to say that we don't have outliers, people who think it is either more or it's even less. And in this case, the authors of the book have talked to a few demographers who believe it's less. I find that argument unpersuasive, and I don't see any scientific arguments supporting the numbers that are provided. The book doesn't really provide any.
But why? Because they're saying that we're already seeing a reduction in population growth rates, in birth rates around the world. So why do you not see the evidence there?
Yeah, but see, here is another very important point. Declines in fertility do not translate immediately into declines in population. We have a continent, sub-Saharan Africa, where today there's 1 billion people. Most of the continent has still very high fertility, and the UN predicts 4 billion people. That is 3 billion more people than today. Africa at the moment has very great difficulty feeding its population. A lot of food is imported, enormous poverty, water shortages, etc. And the UN expects there to be 3 billion more. Now, even if it's 2 billion, or it could be even 5 billion, there's going to be enormous growth in that region. And the UN, I think, makes the right assumptions. It assumes that fertility will decline in sub-Saharan Africa, which is everybody agrees that it will happen. But if you compare the fertility trends in Africa with those in Asia, you find that fertility declines are slower than they were in Asia and Latin America in the 70s and 80s. In fact, there's a new phenomenon that has been discovered in the last two decades, and that is stalling fertility. So if you take Kenya fertility decline started around 1970. It continued to around 1990. And the projections, everybody said, oh, this is great, it will continue. No, it did not. Fertility then stalled for almost two decades, and it's now resuming fertility decline. So there are similar pauses in fertility decline in sub-Saharan Africa that have not been observed in other regions of the world. Right. And those make the slow assumptions made slow. Declines, yes, but not as fast as some people believe.
Right. So if I may, let me just get a chance to give Daryl and John an opportunity to respond here. What would you like to say? John Bongartz seems to say that your take here is quite flawed.
No, well, I would suggest that we have a pretty strong argument to make, and I'll tell you why. The UN puts an awful lot of weight on Africa. By their own admission, their data from Africa is not very good, and which is one of the reasons that the people who put together the Lancet article that came out in November decided to do what they were doing, because they disagree with the way that the UN has put together their data. And in fact, we interviewed the person who was the head of the UN Population Division. And his one message to us was, if you can do one thing through the course of this book, could you please tell people we need better data out of Africa? So Africa is an interesting proposition. I think that the data is still outstanding on that. For example, in Kenya, you know, I went there myself and I interviewed people in Kenya. And I can tell you that their population, their fertility rate has dropped by a whole baby over the space of the last 10 years. So it's happening quite quickly, as is the transformation of their educational system, which is a big impact on fertility and how people are forming families. So I think that there's a pretty good argument that we could have about Africa. I don't think that the science is settled. But laying Africa aside, the really big issues in terms of world population are China and India. Mm. And what we've seen in terms of China is that the UN is projecting in its numbers that China's population fertility rate is actually going to increase over the next while. Well, the Chinese don't even think that. And in India, as John stated earlier in the in our conversation, the UN's telling us that the fertility rate there is 2. Actually, at the time we wrote the book, it was 2.4. The UN's projected it down to 2.3 now. The Lancet study came out and said it was 2.1, which actually confirms what Indian demographers were telling me when I was there. So I think there's a pretty good argument that you can make on the other side of this. And just because the UN was right in the past doesn't mean they're going to be right in the future.
Well, hold that thought. Daryl Bricker, John Ibbotson, and John Bongard, stand by for just a moment because we do have to take a quick break. We are talking about Empty Planet, The Shock of a Global Population Decline. That's Daryl Bricker and John Ibbotson's new book that they have co-authored. Lots more to discuss when we come back. So hang in there, everyone. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with John Ibbotson and Daryl Bricker. They are co-authors of the new book, Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. We're also joined by John Bongartz. He's a demographer and vice president and distinguished scholar at the Population Council, an international NGO that conducts research on health and development issues around the world. And John Bongartz, let me turn back to you here, because before the break, you heard Daryl saying that just because the UN has been perhaps right about population estimates in the past doesn't mean that they're going to be right in the future. So on that point, yesterday I was looking back to a book, or back into a book that you edited in the year 2000, John Bongartz, called Beyond 6 Billion, Forecasting the World's Population. And in that book, there was a really interesting chapter and particular graph that showed, okay, between 1957 and 1998, the UN put out annual population estimates for what the Earth's population would be in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. And you found that on average, the UN's estimate was only off by less than 3%. So, I mean, it doesn't seem like they have been all that wrong in the past, and yet Daryl's saying that they're going to be wildly wrong for the future.
Yeah, that's why I disagree with him. So let me make a critical point that is often confusing, and that is, in fact, John said this, he went to Kenya and said population and fertility are declining. That's not the case. Everywhere in Africa, population is growing very rapidly while fertility is coming down. This is a critical point, and the reason why is that if women have fewer children, they go from 6 to 5 to 4. 4 is twice 2. You need to get to 2 to get eventually population stability. So as long as fertility is above 2, you have a rapidly growing population, even if fertility is going down. That's number one. And the second point is about they mentioned the India estimates, and I'm perfectly happy to accept their number of 2.1 or 2.2 or 2.3. It doesn't matter. What is missing from this discussion is they leave the impression that India's population has stopped growing, which is very far from the truth. And the reason is what mentioned earlier, momentum. So if you look at the momentum in India, India now has a population or had a population of 1.3 billion mm-hmm. in a couple of years ago, with an estimate of 2.1 births per woman, the population will grow by 300 to 400 million more. And this is called momentum. Mm. It is a very powerful force in all the regions, particularly in Africa. And even if in Africa women instantly went to 2.1 births, we would still get a billion more people in Africa. So that is an issue that's not in the book. It's very important and ignored.
Well, can I just, John, I want to give Daryl and John, Daryl Bricker and John Ibbotson a chance to respond there. Would you like to, gentlemen?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we do not do in the book is suggest that population growth has stalled simply because the fertility rate has gone down to 2.1. That's not true, and we would never say such a thing. You do get, Dr. Bangard mentioned, a sort of a one generation of momentum. You still have a very, even if India is at replacement rate, which it is, you're struggling to have one generation of young women who have 2.1 children. But there are a couple of things that are being missed here. First of all, it's only one generation. We don't say that the population of the planet is going to not continue to grow. We're just saying it stops around mid-century and then starts to go down. So India would be a classic case of that. And it won't stay at 2.1 because societies that move from 5 to 4 to 3 to 2 keep going past that. They go down to where we are, 1.5, 1.6, 1.7. And again, as Daryl pointed out, there's a whole lot of information coming out of countries like Kenya to say that the UN assumptions are wrong. One of the things, for example, that I noticed in November was a story, as you know, the Kenyan government has mandated education up to at least grade eight for women as well as for men. In the last test scores that were done at the end of last academic year, as many girls as boys sat for those tests, and the girls did on average better than the boys in terms of the scores. That will have a very quick and emphatic impact on Kenya. It will take a generation before it starts to show up, but it will start to show up in a generation.
Yeah. John Bongartz, I hear you wanting to jump back in here.
Yes. The point about education is an important one because the statistics on education are really quite impressive, and girls and boys are getting a lot of education. But there's something very disturbing in the statistics that is rarely mentioned, and that is that people go through primary school and even sometimes part of secondary school without being able to read a sentence or to write a sentence. In other words, we have a massive expansion of the education system in Africa, but the kids sit in desks and they don't learn very much. Teachers are absent. Class sizes are 100 or 150. This is an example of the adverse consequences of very rapid population growth. The government cannot keep up with the influx of students. So they get a degree, but they really haven't learned very much.
Well, gentlemen, stand by here for just a second because we have a lot of callers who want to join us, so I want to bring at least a couple of them in. Let's go to Julie, who's calling from Beloit, Wisconsin. Julie, you're on the air.
Hello. So this idea that the world population is not exploding at such a rate that it's going to overtake the ability of our resources to manage that is so opposite of anything that I've ever learned, and it makes sense now that you're hearing it. But I have to wonder, so if the mass of young people and working age people is not growing enough or we have so many more elderly people, how is that going to affect our ability to handle world pressures like climate change or something like a world pandemic, which we know statistically is due to happen at some point? What do we do then?
Well, Julie, thank you for your call. Daryl Bricker or John Ibbotson, would you like to respond?
Well, I think in terms of the structure of the population and what the challenges are going to be going forward, That's really the kind of the big point of the book, is that we now have to start thinking about these issues, because exactly as the caller said, you know, the received wisdom is it's going to be in one direction. And what John and I argue is, no, actually, it's probably not going to be in that direction. In fact, there's some pretty good evidence that it'll be in another direction. So the questions that she raises are absolutely the questions that are going to be on the table for discussion.
Well, let's go to Janelle, who's calling from Boca Raton, Florida. Janelle, you're on the air.
Hi. Listen, I have a comment and a question. My comment is similar to the earlier caller, David. I agree. I believe population decline is great. It's not all about us. Humans are the biggest source of pressure on the environment and on other species with which we share this earth. And hopefully, fewer people will allow the earth to heal itself and to stave off the extinction of so many species. My question is different, though. How does increased efficiency and AI affect the decline of the world population? Seems to me that increased efficiency and increased AI means we will need fewer people to fill the jobs.
Okay. So, Janelle, thank you for your call. John Ibbotson, let me turn to you there again. People wanting to explore more about what the consequences might be. I mean, what do you have? What's your response to her about her question about artificial intelligence playing a role here?
Yeah, in terms of the economy, it's an important question, because if you, as I say, we already have a couple of dozen countries with declining populations right now. China starts to lose population within just a very few years. And other countries like Brazil will be following along as well. It is true that productivity increases can take care of some of the issue of labor shortages. Immigration is another great way to take care of those labor shortages. But over time, we might find that automation fills in the jobs that need to be filled in by a declining population. Mm. The problem is that robots don't buy dresses. And if you have an economy in which you have fewer people who are young every year, it is the young who consume most as they set out in life to get together, to buy a house, to have a kid, but only 2.1 or 1.5. And the challenges of economic growth produced by an ever smaller cohort of young mm-hmm. consumers is something that economies are going to have to figure out. And they probably will. You know, we're not doom and gloom. We're not neo-Malthusians in this book. we're just saying it's something we have to take into account.
Well, let's go to Everett, who's calling from Suffolk, Virginia. Everett, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, are there ethnic concerns in your demographics? In the United States, we are such against immigration right now, and we talk about who's going to be in the majority, who will be less. Are there ethnic changes or variables that would be included in your data?
So, Everett, hang on. Do you mean regarding the United States in particular or worldwide?
Worldwide and the United States. Well, the United States in particular, but worldwide.
Okay. Everett, thank you so much for your call. John Bongartz, I'll turn back to you on that. I mean, I'm looking at some recent data for the United States specifically, because as I mentioned earlier in the hour, in the U.S. overall, we're roughly at a 1.7, 1.8 birth rate of children per women, which is under the replacement rate overall. But if you break down the data via ethnicity, I'm seeing here that Hispanic women had the highest fertility rate of the ethnicity studied in the United States, and they passed that 2.1 rate in 29 American states, and that African American women reached that rate in 12 American states. But white women did not reach that 2.1 rate in any state in the United States.
Right. The white Americans are behaving very similar to the West European population. So they're very similar fertility to France, Scandinavia, and UK. So these countries have slightly below replacement fertility. They also have increasing life expectancy, which adds to the population, and they have immigration. So on that, these countries, both the U.S. and the Western and Northern Europe countries, will not decline. They will experience aging, and aging is definitely a problem. But the aging is found in the richest countries in the world, and they are competent and ingenious enough to take care of their elderly problem. The big population problems are in the poor countries in Africa and in Southern Asia, where population growth makes life very miserable still, and where the environment cannot support the growing population. So I think we should pay much more attention to the poor people and the women in these countries than in the rich countries like Japan and so on, because they can take care of themselves.
Well, let's take one more call here. Let's go to Steve, who's also in Suffolk, Virginia today. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. How are y'all today? I was wondering, it seems to me that life expectancy would depress the replacement rate or the birth rate that you would have. And I wonder if in your studies or in your review, there was a correlation between that you found.
Yeah, Steve, thank you for your call. Daryl or John Ibbotson, you want to talk about that?
There's no question.
Well, go ahead,
Daryl, you go ahead. No, all right. There's no question that longevity, in fact, masks what would otherwise be a steeper rate of decline than already exists. People are living longer in both the developed and the developing world. But that only masks it. It doesn't change it irrevocably. And of course, older people they do tend to consume more in terms of healthcare, pensions, and are less productive than younger people. We have that issue as well. We also need to look at the world as a whole. Mm. Brazil, for example, the fifth largest nation on earth, is at 1.8 and is going to experience population decline. The entire Western Hemisphere, forget about the United States and Canada, but if you look at Latin America and the Caribbean, they're now overall at replacement rate. So we really are just focusing this question on a couple of areas, and we agree. Sub-Saharan Africa is one. Southern Asia is another. But we think that the UN numbers are overly pessimistic on Sub-Saharan Africa, and everyone agrees that the numbers in Southern Asia are going down and going down fast.
Well, we just have a couple minutes left to go, and I want to re-ask a particular question about the immediate future in places like the United States, Canada, Europe, and even parts of Asia here. It sounds like with these declining birth rates and perhaps even declining populations that really what we might see is a competition for immigrants in order to, continue healthy economies here. Of course, that has a lot of political implications now, but given the fact that other economies are also rising, is it going to be harder to get the kind of immigrants that Western nations want and need?
The answer to that question is yes. Because the countries that that are most likely to produce immigrants, so if you look at the biggest diaspora in the world today, it's India. Well, they're now at a replacement rate, and their population is aging. The median age continues to go up every year. And immigration is a young person's game. So as the middle class status of people in India continues to rise, and it's one of the fastest growing middle classes in the world, their population birth rates decline and their median age increases, that pool of people that's available to the rest of the world is going to decline. So yeah, we're probably going to have that type of competition, and it's going to be countries that are more enlightened about how to deal with immigration, like Canada, for example, that are going to do the best job of dealing with this, I would argue. Mm.
Well, we have about a minute left to go, and John Bongartz, as the demographer here at the table, I want to turn back to you. Overall, what's your final thought for, what we might see a couple of decades down the line in terms of global population? Regardless of what it is, do you think the world's ready to handle however many people we might have?
That's a good. Let me make one final point, and that is that the title of this book is misleading. It says An Empty Planet. And there's no way we're going to have an empty planet. In fact, the question that we're debating is how much more overpopulated the world will be. Even if we accept the projection that are made in the book of 9 billion, we today stand at 7.5 billion, and we are already overpopulated. We are ruining our environment in multiple ways. If they're right, we're going to have 1.5 billion more. If the UN is right, there's going to be 3 billion more. Either way, adding every billion people we add to the planet makes life more difficult
right.
for other people, for the poor, and for the environment.
Well, John Bongartz, demographer and vice president and distinguished scholar at the Population Council, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Daryl Bricker and John Ibbotson, co-authors of Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. We have an excerpt of the book at onpointradio.org. Very provocative, very interesting book. John and Daryl, thank you both so much for being with us this hour.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Folks, go to onpointradio.org, read the excerpt of the book, let us know what you think. Do we have it wrong in terms of population projections for humanity on planet Earth? by the year 2100? And if so, what does it mean? Again, go to onpointradio.org and let us know. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.